So I'm introducing Greg Marston today. Greg Marston is a senior lecturer at the director of the Social Policy Unit in the School of Social Work and Human Services at the University of Queensland. Marston's scholarship spans a wide swath of social policy arenas, including public housing, employment services, and refugee resettlement. Emphasizing moments of shift, disruption, and even obfuscation, his work deploys critical discourse analysis, street-level bureaucracy theories, and governmentality studies to furnish consistently thick accounts of how the welfare state is legislated by governments, interpreted by media relays, and implemented at the agency level. I see in Marston's body of research a perpetual interrogation of policy's latent meanings and of how its silences and contradictions tacitly govern its subjects. In each of his major publications, Marston interrogates the new direction of social welfare, showing how it obscures socially relevant tensions at the formal level and leaves it to agency workers to settle on the ground. Discretionary relationships, where ambiguities are settled between social workers and service recipients, thereby become sites of regulation that govern not through coercion, but through consent. On this point, his work insists that placing the problems of social welfare back within the context of power and authority that new managerialism elides is a necessary step towards its repoliticization. Marston's work, an ongoing search for meaningful intervention, has been influential in guiding my own research project. His essay on community-based organizations has helped me to think about the transition to community services as a fragile contemporary moment, where the stakes of human services are being subtly yet consequentially redrawn. If he is correct, the devolutionary trends towards increasingly more community-based solutions has, quote, left nonprofits standing alone on the platform of a welfare state largely stripped of its supporting redistributive foundations, unquote, then we must radically rethink how we mobilize community to justify welfare programs. In fact, Marston's work often prods us in just this way, unpacking the latent implications of dense policy meanings and showing how inattention to their contradictions enables policy shifts that we might otherwise contest if they were made explicit. By making the implicit explicit, Marston's work builds a purchase for action that we would otherwise lack. It is with great eagerness and appreciation that I welcome Greg Marston to our Centennial Symposium.
I'm intimidated by my introduction. I'm going to do a fairly unsophisticated paper today. I've really delved into more empirical material to talk about how workfare has played out in Australia. Can I first say, though, that it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the introduction, Evelyn, and everyone else who's put this event together. It's good. It's my second time in the US. The first time was in 1996, and we had Clinton, and of course, was signing off on the TANF reforms. I happen to be here because we just had a change of government in Australia from a Labor government under Keating to John Howard, who was the Conservative leader, who then held power for the next 11 years. So for me, it was a good time to leave the country. I also didn't have a job. I was working in Canberra with a lobby group called National Shelter, which is an NGO that lobbied governments on behalf of low-income housing consumers, homeless populations, to get a better deal, basically, on public housing. And I was one of those organisations that lost our 80% of funding from the federal government. So many of us didn't have a job. So I did what most Australians did and brought the round-the-world ticket and didn't come back to Australia until about 8 months later. The thing about our leaders and the differences and the similarities between the two countries became more acute in the years after that, because we had John and George, who became good friends. As you all know, John was here when the Twin Towers were bombed, and they shared lots of common interests and common kind of policy convergences, particularly around foreign policy. Anyway, John, unlike George, is not writing his memoirs. I did hear that, is this true, that George Bush is writing an account of his years in office? Someone is, okay. Because we had Thomas Mann out from the Brookings Institute last week, who was talking about the optimism in America despite the appalling economic statistics, right? He was talking about the first days of the Obama administration. And one of the things he said that a journalist asked George Bush about this book was that George said in response that he was keen to make this the most authoritarian account of his term in office. I think he meant... So I can see how you're going to miss him as well, as much as we're going to miss our John, you know, in Australia. And we've now got Kevin, which is a very Australian name for a Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, right? It's not nearly as a greater name as Barack Obama, unfortunately, but we've got our Kevin, and we're very proud because he speaks Mandarin. And we're a little concerned in Australia that he's a bit too close to China, at least the opposition party is, because he goes to these conventions and speaks in Mandarin with the Australian opposition sitting in the audience and the Australian diplomats sitting in the audience who can't understand a word that Kevin says. But he's probably happy about this. So now we have a different leader. Do we have different sets of policies? I'm going to talk today a little bit about the changes that happened, I guess, starting in 1998, and some of this has been touched on in the early panel, about the changing governance arrangements, about how we privatised the Commonwealth Employment Service. Talk a little bit about the policies, the more acute changes that came in 2006, and then discuss how this has all been played out in organisations. And as I said, I'm not doing social theory today because that was Paris, which is the other centennial event that I've been involved in. As Evelyn said, I'm double dipping. I've been in two centennial events, one in Paris, one in Chicago, two both great cities, and I'm not going to say which one I like the best, at least not publicly, anyway. So the other one in Paris was much more about the connections with social theory, and so I won't be talking about Foucault, but I was glad that at least Sanford talked and mentioned his name this morning, so I felt a little bit that I could indulge the notion of discipline, perhaps, in my presentation. I think, by the way, the note about discipline, I think that this morning we're talking about it being a discipline on the unemployed and discipline on the frontline workers. I think the other thing about discipline in the context of welfare to work policies is it's also a discipline on low-wage workers. It's the kind of sending the message that part of the audience is that, you know, you don't want to give up this crappy job because the welfare system's looking pretty crappy as well. It's, in fact, it's that principle of lesser eligibility that Richard Titmus talked about, that you always got to make the welfare system look worse than the worst paid job. And I think that partly that's what the notion of the race to the bottom is. So I think discipline is important, but power's also productive when you look at the workers, and I'll talk a little bit about that. The issue of framing, I liked how we got to talk a little bit about that this morning, and the connection between the experience of welfare workers, how they frame what they do, how that connects to the broader policy, I think is a really important question that came up in that panel this morning. I've been a bit influenced by the work of George Lakoff, the cognitive scientist, you know, and he's thinking about the importance of frames. And it seems to me that part of the issue with the welfare to work debate is that we're amounting lots of evidence that is quite critical of the policy and shows the various ways in which on different dimensions it fails, but that doesn't have much of an impact on the political, transformation that continues unabated. And Lakoff's point is that, you know, the frames don't fit the fact. It's the facts that get discounted in many cases. I mean, some other people don't change their frames, but we're not all that conscious of our frames. And so his work is about taking responsibility, I guess, for certainly on the left of politics to be much more assertive about the things that we stand for rather than letting the Conservatives define the debate about what responsibility means as an example of that. Because it's not that progressives don't care about responsibility, indeed they do, but they don't frame it in quite the same way as the Conservatives do. So I think framing is important and how that gets back to the broader political landscape. The other resource that I think is important in organisations in all of this welfare to work debate is that the helping resources are important, and indeed what managerialism I think has done is diminished another important resource, which is a public language. So having a language within which we can talk about these social problems and moral problems. There's a great book by Keating's advisor called Death Sentence. And it's all about what managerialism has done to our capacity to have a conversation about the social problems we have, because managerialism reduces lots of social problems to a language that's got no emotion, for instance. And emotion is another neglected dimension of lots of policy practice. In that sense, I think what policy workers do at the front line is a lot of interpretation, but one of their resources they're not given, at least formally, is the language that helps them to think through these problems. They certainly get that through their professional training and social work education, but that often is in conflict with the sorts of things they're asked to do in terms of implementing policy. So I think overall, this is my last general remark, I think we should be interrogating the problem framing because we're often jumping into what the solutions are. You know, so we have to interrogate how the problem is framed, because that inevitably informs the sorts of solutions that are adopted. And that's certainly something that I try to instill in my students of policy, is that the importance of language, the importance of frames, and getting stuck into ways in which we have these debates about things like welfare dependency, for instance, which is a classic example of saying that one form of dependency is problematic, that is state dependency, while labour market dependency is all good. And what that does is doesn't put the gaze on work and work practices nearly enough. It problematises the welfare system and state support. Anyway, so I'll shut up, but I think those points connect with some of the things that are going on in Australia and more broadly with things that we've talked about today. So contestability is the last C. I love my alliteration here. The topic is, title has changed a few times. And if I get to talk about that, I'll illustrate the ways in which this isn't, as I said, just rolling out, that there has been lots of variation, there's been lots of contestation, and there has been some shifts, and that's not just coincided with a change from a Conservative government to now a Labor administration in Australia. In terms of the political context, very quickly, don't know how much you know about the welfare state. You probably know more about Steve Irwin and his tragic death than necessarily the finer features of the Australian welfare state. But nonetheless, I mean, we're kind of in the same camp, often put in terms of typologies with the US, with New Zealand, Canada and so forth, as a liberal welfare state. We're kind of, in some ways, though, the best of a bad bunch. I mean, we have some reasonable universal benefits in the form of health and education, at least up until university level, where the costs start to get exorbitant. We don't have unemployment insurance, so it funds people's benefits out of general revenue, out of tax. That sets up a divide between taxpayers and welfare recipients, a quite bitter cultural divide in our country. The role of the government has been very mixed in Australia's history. We started with charities much like the US. Governments became a reluctant provider after post-World War II, and now they're putting some of their important functions that they were delivering out into the market, both with non-profits and for-profits. But nonetheless, in terms of employment assistance, we did have a Commonwealth Employment Service, and now we don't, and we talked about this in the last panel. So the Howard government set up this quasi-market and rolled out the tendering of what formerly was done by a public service provider to a range of non-profits and for-profits. And he did this in the name of efficiency, in the name of flexibility and innovation, but it was also a very direct move to destabilise a fairly powerful union within the Commonwealth public sector. And so it had some stated and unstated aims. I'll be very quick about this. Recent social policy changes. We've had what we call mutual obligation, which the only mutual part of the government is we'll give you income support assistance. Most of the obligations are on the unemployed. We do have forms of workfare, so if you stay unemployed, we're going to put you in compulsory work programs for your receipt of your benefit, and they're usually about 20 to 25 hours a week for 6 months. But that's all changing too with the recent reforms. The welfare to work policies intensified after July 2006, and this is the opportunity that we asked Evelyn to come out to Australia to talk about the US experience, because we were rolling out mutual obligation to a larger number of groups. So now it wasn't just young unemployed, it was sole parents, people with disabilities, the older workers who came under the umbrella of mutual obligation, and also subject to the work test. So we changed not just the welfare governance by privatising the CES, we also changed the income support system. We moved a lot of these people off a pension payment, which is much more generous, to an unemployment assistance, which is, has a lot of strings attached. The other thing we've done in Australia, which was very unpopular and which in part led to the downfall of the Howard government, was try to reform our industrial relations system. Now, this affected a lot of people, and there's a lot of angst about this, and our union ran a very effective campaign about what this would do to working conditions in the lead-up to the 2007 election. And that was part of the downfall of the government. But it's important to put them on the same slide because they were part of the same reform. We had to make work less regulated. We had to devolve it to individuals in terms of industrial relations at the same time as we were changing the welfare system. And part of the condition of losing your benefit was if you refused a reasonable job offer, at least in the ways in which these two sets of policies interacted. But these changes have now been revoked because part of the reason that Rudd got in was because he said, we get into power, we'll throw these changes out. And so that's what they're going through the process of at the moment. So work and welfare were both being intensively reformed over the past decade. All right, that's enough of context. My colleague Catherine MacDonald and I do this fun stuff where we use, and Fleming Larson has done this as well, we use the espoused theories to see whether they actually do work in practice, so we take them at face value. So we've written two papers on this, one about quasi-markets, another one about do unemployed people actually, are they more motivated? Is there more self-efficacy as a result of welfare to work? Because that's another claim that's often made in justifying them. And in both cases, the shorter answer is no, it's not really a quasi-market. And no, people generally feel worse after being in a welfare to work system, particularly after 12 months to 2 years. So that's the short end answer. You don't have to read the rest of these two slides to get that. But just to say that it looks more like a market in the beginning, it's looked less like a market over time. Okay, it's harder for consumers to exit the system. They can't choose the provider in the way in which they could initially. There's less providers. There's very little trust. In fact, it became openly hostile in the last days of the Howard government. And this has in part led to the whole reform of when the new government came in. They said, we're going to put it all back on the table and let's look at this again. Unfortunately, what they didn't put back on the table was the competition itself. They said that we're going to keep the competitive tendering model, but you can tell us about how you'd like to improve it. I mean, what we say in our paper is that mostly the problems are a consequence of the competition and the competitive tendering, and that's what needs to change in order to fix some of these consequences. But in short, what it did was become as much like the bureaucracy, which was the criticism, as the bureaucracy it replaced. I mean, there was this huge administrative burden, and I'll talk a bit about that if I can get a chance. How have these policies played out? This has also been touched on this morning, but NGOs have always existed. They've more been the result of contract and programs. But they're much less willing to share what works. Contract compliance, as I said, is consuming vast amounts of time and money. People are spending much less time working with people about how to get them into work in a genuine kind of way, and are more or less ticking boxes and generated often by computer systems. It's been an integral part of the ways in which we've rolled out welfare to work has been the ICTs. The audit culture is everywhere in terms of this contract compliance. And this is just a quote from a Catholic Social Services about the extent to which they're audited. So even for spending $14 on someone, the auditor from the department will come in and look at the reason in which you gave that unemployed person $14. The perverse effect of this is that this account that's supposedly available for unemployed people has been massively underspent. So 80% of the funding that was available wasn't spent in the 12 months because of this. In other words, it's too much trouble. What I want to share is some quotes from work we did in 2005-2007 in the last few minutes I've got from workers and from unemployed people. This was quite effective when we published, and this was around the time that everyone was here, when we published our research on how workers felt, which is similar to what ELSE is doing in surveying in 2008. It upset the government a great deal more than when we were banging on about how bad it was for the unemployed, because they undermined legitimacy in a way, because the unemployed were already demonised, but the workers in the system weren't. And so when we started to say they've got poor conditions, they're unhappy, they're leaving, then the minister had to respond, and responded quite forcefully by saying, we're going to cut the red tape, we're going to do a lot to improve the situation. So I think there's an important political lesson there in terms of the way in which we do research and who we do research with, not just always on the recipients. But also the workers. But I love the language of cattle and stock, which is how people were referred to in the system. I've already mentioned about staff turnover. Burning out many staff was a common response. These are just illustrative quotes of what I'm talking about. And so a lot of people were leaving, and the most experienced people were the ones that were leaving. Okay, so as we're putting the hardest cases in, the best workers are gone. And that was an unfortunate outcome of this process. This was just my lovely little slide called Andre, which highlights what happens in these organisations in terms of the specialist and the new professionals that come in terms of the governance. Because the contract tender documents are 500 pages long, right? So these are the sorts of names that you get, human resource managers, marketing managers. And you've got poor old Andre in the ditch, right? I don't know if you can read the bottom line, but the financial crisis is forcing companies to make some tough decisions. There's a risk that we might need to lay off Andre. And Andre's the only one doing the work. I mean, it's a classic kind of cartoon about NGOs, I think, too. Certainly in Australia, it's the most sophisticated work, the most difficult work that's the least rewarded in these organisations. We pay our frontline staff a pittance, and yet we pay the policy people a whole lot bloody more. And I think that's absolutely wrong. But anyway, so Andre's going to lose his job. And that's certainly the case in the latest contract round. Many frontline workers have lost their jobs because of the latest announcement. I'll talk about that if I can get it. A minute. We tracked 75 long-term unemployed people over 3 years, and this is only one quote from reams of data. But I just want to bring this one in because it ties to the notion in which we're setting up this market, and that the unemployed, we're very conscious of that that's how they're being constructed in this system, certainly towards the end, as this quote illustrates, that they're our market in that sense. They see themselves as part of a machine, that they're there as kind of fodder, and that they're only going to be invested in if there's some sort of financial outcome for the organisation. And as I said, there's a whole lot of evidence, not just our own, that says that a lot of this punitive stuff is counterproductive, as I said, in terms of self-efficacy. So I think that's important to draw in. And as Els was saying earlier, the views of the unemployed are important because they are a very poorly organised group in this whole system. We have some very weak welfare rights organisations in Australia that are poorly funded. We have some public unemployment units, but they're really not part of the policy community in deciding these directions. And again, that's part of our responsibility. All right, my last minute, new developments. This is the most stark new development, is that when they were designing the new system when the government came in 2008, unemployment was at a record low, 30-year record low. Now it's going to climb, expected to climb to 10% next year. So we've designed this system to try to get the most long-term unemployed who were getting the least out of the system some assistance. At the same time, we're throwing a whole lot of newly unemployed people into the system. So the model, if you like, was designed for the wrong sort of economic climate. But we're now implementing it in a time where we're going to go back to record unemployment. And you can imagine all the hidden contract costs and that's going on about having to rewrite these tenders that are going to be hidden transaction costs. The other thing about this is employment services increasingly transnational. In fact, the Prime Minister's wife used to run a very profitable employment service contract agency that's now doing very well in the UK and Germany. But in their last contract round in Australia, good old Maximus from the US, who we call in Australia Max Employment, are picking up a lot of the contracts. And they spent $1 million writing their contract, hiring people to write their contract. That's a resource that no NGO had, basically, in terms of getting those contracts. As a result of those decisions, 3,000 workers are going to lose their jobs, mostly from NGOs. And so the Greens and the opposition party have set up a Senate inquiry to investigate this tender process. Now, this is the first time this happened. The broad terms of reference are actually quite favourable because they're not just saying what went on in this tender process, but is this a good model? So the Senate inquiry has got some quite wide-ranging terms of reference. So it's another political opportunity to raise some questions about this model. All right, my last slide. This picks up on the theme about success and failure. I think I stole this from Evelyn Brodkin, actually, Unacknowledged, a story of political success and policy failure. Is that you, Evelyn? All right, good. It doesn't, in terms of what you measure, it doesn't very much about long-term unemployment, but it's still popular. And again, that's the case in the US, I would say. That's one of our similarities. The intellectual project, we talked about this in the last session, may be in trouble, but there's not much evidence that it's losing any of its transforming vigour once it's been embedded in these kinds of organisational and governance arrangements. So it's still alive and well. I think Jamie Peck talked about it as a zombie. So neoliberalism has its intellectual head cut off, but it's still walking around out there, basically. The competitive tendering has had quite a dramatic effect on social advocacy. We used to write gagging clauses into these NGO contracts so they couldn't publicly criticise the minister or the policy without first getting their press release agreed to by the minister. This was the extent to which this went. These gagging clauses were revoked. User rights, which is a topic of the next panel, have been substantially weakened, both procedurally but also in terms of entitlements. Procedurally because people have access to a 1-800 number if they want to complain about these NGOs or private companies, the service they receive, whereas when it was a public model, you could go all the way to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. Sorry, administrative law is no longer an option for most of these people. The last thing about it, all this, and this is a whole other favourite topic of mine, is about the work fetish in Australian social policy, and that it's disappointing to see that the new Rudd government is basically running the same flag when it's adopted what it calls new social inclusion, which looks like old social policy, because mostly it's about work, work and work, as if that's the only way in which we measure the value of being a social citizen. So it's more intensification both for the workers, but I also think in terms of the ethic. And I think that that's an issue that we ought to be deeply concerned about, given that that institution of work does fail to deliver what it used to deliver in the post-World War II period. It's not delivering the sorts of things that people promised it would deliver. And so we need to think of other ways in which to create our means and forms of thinking about people as being included, because work's pretty much broken, at least in our country. Good-o. I'll stop. I've used too much of my time. Thanks.
Well, we've come to that point in the day where we are ready to have a roundtable and take up questions of what does this mean? What else do we need to be thinking of? What can we make of what has been an interesting look from many different vantage points and incorporating many different metaphors? And I can't resist, as chair, using my discretion to add my metaphor of choice. It has been, 1996. It's been 12, 13 years. I'm trying to think what exactly date I want to come to since Bill Clinton signed welfare reform and workfare into law here, and one of his advisors famously said, "Good, we won't have that dead cat hung around our necks anymore." My metaphor of choice. Indeed, as many people have just said, poverty were taken off the table and displaced, the new lingua franca being all about work. And yet, there is no work. These kinds of shifts make us singularly ill-prepared for the kind of crisis we're encountering. We are busy reforming the poor, but we haven't been quite so busy reforming the market to provide opportunities for them. However, some others have managed to get the dole in the amount of trillions. So, that being said, the questions that this roundtable, I think, is going to help us ask is, how do we now think about the prospects for individuals who are subject to these new regimes to seek redress and social justice from the state? How do we think about the future of lower wage work, both over time and in this crisis? What can we learn from the experiences of trying to balance these notions of work-based and welfare-based system, particularly in Denmark? And what is the future of new managerialism, and how can we understand its implications for organizing work? With that, I turn things over to Michael Adler.
Well, good afternoon. I'm losing my voice, so I hope I can get through 15 minutes. 15 minutes is a good thing for me, because I don't know that my voice will last longer than that. Evelyn, thank you so much for this invitation. I've enjoyed the day enormously. I thought I had a pitch. That is, I thought I had an answer to some of the questions raised in the program. But in the course of the day, I've begun to question whether I've got the right answer. The question that I asked from the floor suggests that I might now give a different answer. Perhaps what we need to do is to rethink this emphasis on conditionality, on forcing unemployed people to go through hoops and jump over hurdles in order to qualify for assistance because they are not conscientious enough in looking for jobs. Looking for jobs when there are no jobs available doesn't seem to me like a very sensible policy. But the answer that I had prepared in advance of today was a somewhat different one. It was that we need to place greater emphasis on justice and fairness in the implementation of welfare-to-work programs. This certainly applies in the UK, And on the basis of much that I've heard today, but I think it applies in other countries as well. I'm going to start with a somewhat...
Wrong way, the other way. Yeah. One.
A somewhat stylized and oversimplified account of developments that have led to welfare-to-work programs in the United Kingdom. We've witnessed a marriage between two hitherto independent policy actors, social security and employment policies, with reference to something that Matthias said, this was not a shotgun marriage. The marriage was preceded by various forms of cohabitation. But the effect is that we have moved, as you will see on the overhead, from a situation in which we had separate policy domains, separate agencies to administer those policies, and separate government departments responsible for policy, to one now in which we have one policy, one welfare-to-work policy, administered by one agency called Job Centre First, and responsible or accountable to one government department in terms of a concept that Fleming Larson used. I think the UK must now qualify as a workfare country. Well, each of the two formerly independent policy actors and the merged policy entity have had to balance help and control. The balance has changed over time. I mean, by help, I refer to the provision of social security for those who are not able to work, and the provision of job search and training to help people back into the labour market. By control, I refer to the increased, or I refer to compulsion, and to the fact that job search and training has become a condition for the receipt of Social Security now, and to sanctions for non-compliance. Over the period resulting, leading up to the present, we've seen an increase in the UK in the importance of control. We've seen increased compulsion. Job search and training are in the UK as elsewhere, or they used in the UK and elsewhere to be voluntary. Now in the UK, they are increasingly compulsory. Sanctions were originally restricted just to the receipt of Social Security. Now they are applied to participation in job search and training. Sanctions were originally applied to the unemployed. Now sanctions are applied to lone parents and disabled people as well. The result is that the number of sanctions has increased. In my paper, I include a lot of data which suggests that in 2005 we were running at 200,000 sanctioned persons a year. I'm sure that number is now considerably greater. And the severity of those sanctions has also increased over time. The maximum period of a sanction, which used to be 6 weeks, is now 26 weeks. The sanctions which used to be applied to the benefit that an unemployed person was entitled to are now applied to the whole family, to all members of the household. The emergence of a welfare to work strategy in the UK, as elsewhere, has coincided with a shift from a passive to an active approach. Our experiences in this respect, similar to those from other countries. I've indicated here what I mean by the terms passive and active. passive function of Social Security is to prevent hardship by providing a decent replacement income for those who lose their job. Active, its function is to change people's labour market behaviour by getting them back into work and discouraging them from relying on benefits. Now, this shift from passive to active approaches in providing for those outside the labour market has led to, first, a change in the balance between rights and responsibilities, and second, has implications for citizenship. Now, in trying to understand the changes in the balance between rights and responsibilities and their implications for citizenship, I've been very influenced by the writings of a prominent political theorist in the United Kingdom called Raymond Plant. Raymond Plant is not only a prominent political theorist, he's also very close to the Labour Party, and he now sits in the House of Lords. Raymond Plant described an oscillation between what he called status-based approaches or conceptions of citizenship, in which citizenship was based on poverty, which he characterized as involving rights for the poor without responsibilities, and what he called contribution-based approaches based on virtue, in which there were, in which rights were balanced by responsibilities. Now, I agree with one of the speakers this morning who said that history does not repeat itself. I'm not persuaded that the pendulum simply goes from one position to the other and then back again. I think Plant himself has failed to understand the difference between the contribution approach promoted by Beveridge and prominent or dominant in Britain in the years after the Second World War, with the what I have called reciprocity approach, based approach, which is characteristic now. Both involve a balancing of rights and responsibilities, but whereas in the contribution-based approach, my sense that is backward-looking, it relates to the contributions that people made in the past when they were employed, and that is different, in my view, to the reciprocity approach, in which rights are balanced by current and future responsibilities. It relates to people's behaviour in the here and now. Now, I think there are a number of problems associated with this approach. It is, you won't be surprised to hear me say, problematic when no work is available. The figures in the UK are rather similar to those described by Greg in Australia. For the last 10 to 15 years, unemployment in the UK has fluctuated around 5%. It's currently, I read in the paper on the day that I left, 7%, and it is likely to go on rising, probably to about 10%, as in Australia. Now, there is a danger, I think, that those who are not, well, first point, the policies that we have in place, I think, don't fit a situation where no work or little work is available, and the government is not prepared to act as employer of last resort. There is a danger, as I've indicated in the slide, that those who are not really able to work will be treated as work shy and subjected to sanctions, and both problems are likely to become more serious as the financial crisis worsens and as unemployment rises. Now, the developments that I have described also have implications for administrative justice, that is, for the justice inherent in administrative procedures. In attempting to study and to understand administrative justice, I ought to acknowledge my indebtedness to an American public laureate, Jerry Mayshore, and his, to my mind, path-breaking book, Bureaucratic Justice, which was a study of the American disability insurance system, which was published 25 years ago. Mayshore defines administrative justice, that is the justice inherent in routine day-to-day administration, in terms of those qualities of a decision process that provide arguments for the acceptability of the decisions that result from those administrative procedures. He identifies three models, each of which is or was associated with a different conception of administrative justice, one based on what he called bureaucratic rationality, a second based on what he called professional treatment, and a third based on what he called moral judgment. Now, he contended that these three models were competitive rather than mutually exclusive. That means that the more you have of one, the less you will have of the others, but they are not mutually exclusive. They don't. It isn't a case of if you have one, you can't have the others. These models can and do, according to Mayshore, coexist with each other. The trade-offs that are made in practice, and likewise those that could be made, reflect the concerns and the bargaining strengths of the institutional actors who have an interest in promoting them. And you can see that civil servants, bureaucrats, clerks have an interest in promoting the bureaucratic rationality model. Doctors, social workers, employment counselors have an interest in promoting the professional treatment model, whereas lawyers, advocacy workers, and rights workers have an interest in promoting the moral judgment model. Now, I have amended and extended Jerry Mayshore's approach, and the overhead here, which, if you can read it, depicts six models characterized in a somewhat different way in terms of the mode of decision-making, the legitimating goal, the mode of accountability, and the mode of redress. The additional models, the managerial model, the consumerist model, and the market model, are models that I have added to take account of developments since he wrote, or since he published his book. I've also renamed, rather more simply, the three models that he put forward. Now, let me indicate how I'm going to use, very briefly, how I'm going to use this by returning to procedures for making decisions relating to those who are outside the labour market. Ooh. You've got it. It's very sensitive. There we go. Before the New Deal, that is before the bringing together of these separate policy domains, the someone called an adjudication officer was king. Was really the gatekeeper. The adjudication officer determined entitlement to Social Security using a mixture of rule enforcement associated with the bureaucratic model of decision making and adjudication associated with the legal model. And as I put here, it was the bureaucratic and legal models of decision making that characterized the activities of the adjudication officer. As a result of the New Deal, the position of the adjudication officer has declined. They are no longer particularly important. Their role as gatekeepers or as king is now taken by people called personal advisors. The personal advisor advises on job search, training, childcare, and in-work benefits using a mixture of discretion and human resource management skills. And in terms of the models of decision-making that I have described, the professional and managerial models of decision-making are now the important ones. Now, this has a very considerable implications for accountability and redress. You'll see I've taken the four models that were associated with first the adjudication officer and then the personal advisor. And the bureaucratic and the legal models have got a minus next to them because they have diminished in importance. And I've characterized them by accountability. Bureaucratic model, administrative review. If you, you don't like a decision, it is reviewed by the superior of the person who made it. The legal model, if you don't like a decision, you take it to a tribunal, would rather like a hearing in front of an administrative law judge. Now, they've diminished in importance. They have the minuses. The modes of decision-making associated with the personal advisor are the professional and managerial. They have a plus next to them. And, what's the mode of accountability? Well, I put here a second opinion or a complaint to a professional body. That's the characteristic one. But in the case of welfare-to-work programs, that's not available. And then in the case of the managerial model, the mode of accountability is audit, this sort of top-down approach. That has increased in importance, not as much as in Australia, as Greg has described. But yes, I'm on the last slide. What are the implications of this? Well, they are that personal advisors now exercise a great deal of power over those who are required to take part in New Deal programs, but it's becoming increasingly difficult for anyone to challenge what they do or do not do. There are few appeals against the imposition of sanctions, largely because it's very hard to identify a decision that they make that can be really challenged. It's almost impossible to challenge their performance, what they do for the people they are meant to help. Well, we are invited just to place our trust in those who administer welfare to work programs. My argument is that trust is not enough. Welfare to work may be a fine ideal, but in the UK it's being implemented without due regard to justice and fairness, and that is something we ought to pay more attention to. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Henning Jorgensen.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me here. I'm glad to be here, but I must also say that I'm the unlucky Dane today. Why? Firstly, because Evelyn asked me to talk about the Danish flexicurity system, and I have been doing this so often during the last 3 years, traveling all over Europe and also outside Europe, and I think it could be a little bit boring for me, but I hope there's some information to you coming here from the United States. Secondly, it's also because this is a sad story I'm going to tell you about, namely the changes in Danish labor market policy as Central Park, part of the famous Danish flexicurity system. I think you all know the story of Hans Christian Andersen about the ugly duckling becoming a beautiful swan. Now, this might be a story, a backward mapping Hans Christian Andersen story, today about a beautiful swan becoming more like an ugly duckling.
Well, then okay. You can talk about something else.
That's why I call it from a beautiful swan to an ugly duckling. This is, of course, also about activation. And, you know, it's part of the modernization of welfare systems. Everyone is stressing those common threats. Employment is going to be the goal and central mechanism that is going to integrate people in society. We have now a new moralism built into the contractual arrangements, and we also see new economic citizenship also being developed. This means that people think we will have the same results all over Europe, all over the world, and we aren't. I fully agree with Matthias Knut. It is actually diversity because of the institutional conditions, because of the actor systems working in national ways mostly. That means we have different concepts of labor market policy. We have different expenditure levels, different priorities and procedures. Just have a look here at the expenditures of labor market policy, and you would see how different the countries actually behave. Denmark is at the top. We are world champion. both as to passive and active labor market policy expenditures. And the United States is at the bottom. We use 10 times more on labor market policy than is the case in this country. Just to say we have diversity and we will have diversity. I'm sure of this. Of course, the construction of activation systems can be based on egalitarian values or paternalistic values. And the Danish activation system was developed during the 19th, actually based on egalitarian values all the way through, because it has been part of the universal welfare state system in Scandinavia. And this has repercussions as to what the changes will be, the result of the changes. In order to understand this, you also need to know something about the Danish labor market system, in which the social partners, representatives of the employers and the employees, actually for more than 100 years has been making collective agreements and doing a lot of regulations which the politicians aren't to intervene in. That means we made the first ever general agreement in the world in 1899, and ever since the politicians say, also what is going to happen in the labor market, we leave this to a certain extent to the social partners themselves. Secondly, when we are making political interventions, the social partners should participate in policy making and in implementation as well. We have a densely organized labor market. We have negotiated solutions. In Denmark, it is contacts that counts, not contracts. That means social dialogues at every level of society has been the basis. This is also supported by the high social capital found in this country. You need to understand this. Then, developing labor market policy from 1904, especially, and then we have generous unemployment benefit systems, actually socializing the cost of flexibility, but also socializing the risks of being unemployed. And I think that's important, because what you see in a lot of other systems now is individualizing risk means that suddenly you also depoliticize the whole question of unemployment, of poverty, and so on. That's one of our problems. Together with Sweden, Finland, and Norway, we share a Nordic approach, having a policy mix of macroeconomic policy, private wage policy in collective agreements, and welfare state activities taking on. And again, you can see I place the social partners in the middle of everything. That means this is also highly corporatist countries. Corporatist countries, yeah. Flexicurity, here you need to make a distinction, because here the Scandinavian countries also differ a little bit. A differentiation between job protection, which is actually high in Sweden, but is very low in Denmark. Here we are with the Anglo-American experiences. We have the social system. Yes, it's high, but you can see we have differences. The Danish flexicurity system, it's not a model. It's not something that you can copy immediately. But this is some relationship that had been built into the system during a longer period of time. Between a highly flexible labor market, meaning that mobility is really high in Denmark. Every third person in the Danish labor market actually changes job every year. Why do they do this? Because they have high income security, we have generous unemployment benefits and relatively high social assistance, and secondly, we also know that the state, the public sector is there with active labor market and educational policies in order that you can be reintegrated into the open labor market system. And that's a lot of traffic going on. It is actually a system making transitions pay. Not making work pay, but making transitions pay. And you can also add that as to further educational training and education, this is a country that has built into a system what we seen from the side of the wage earners could call the security of the wings, because you get qualifications in order to change jobs all the time. Now, the reform in 1993-94 was as to content and as to steering. We started taking it seriously, where were the individual unemployed persons, made an individual action plan, and giving this person activation offers, qualitatively good offers, and mostly education has been in part of this. Secondly, we made a regionalization of labor market policy, having the social partners again in pivotal positions. And we actually succeeded. You can see the Danish unemployment figures went down, leaving the European average. I also put Germany into it, Matthias, in order that you can follow yourself. Still having more than 3.5 million persons unemployed, we went down last year to less than 2%. Yes, and you are a world leader in exports. But why do Germany still place themselves up there? It's also because they've had these new Hartz reforms you were talking about, and that means people actually getting scared of losing their job. And that means if you're scared, you're not using money, and then domestic demand will be excessive. So, again, you will not have full employment. This is another story in Denmark, because for 4 years you know how your income support will be if you're insured. And also, the Phillips curve actually flattened out for those economists, knowing that there's a choice on your menu between high wage increases and unemployment. No, actually, we succeeded in having no inflation. Now, then a new situation popped up with a new right-wing government in 2001, and 2 years later a new system was implemented. We skipped individual action plans. Instead, it was only job plans. It was jobs, jobs, jobs. They said, then we introduced outsourcing of activities from the public employment service system and the offers, as you can see, guidance, qualification, trainee service, and wage subsidies. Again, in 2007, as Flemming Larsen told you, there was a change now as to the processes and the organization of this whole system. At one tier system in which we made job centers, common job centers between the municipalities and the public employment service, we skipped regional labor market policy, we skipped those formerly cooperatist bodies at the regional level, and instead we made this decentralized system, 91 different job centers. This means that, as to the content, we didn't need to fight unemployment any longer. Now it was the supply of labor that was the problem. And activation was also changing its shape and its content. Now people have to be threatened by coming into activation measures. Because they saw, some economists saw, that when you are about to have activation measures, which you have as to the right structure in the Danish system, then people suddenly could find a job themselves, they said. So there were some changes there. As to the processes, the social partners are suddenly out. They can give advice, but they can make no decision. They have no power. They have no money, as was previously the case. That means also coordination has weakened and contractualization has popped in instead. And as to the polity, I would say we have a schizophrenic mixture of control and competition at this moment. You decentralize the responsibility, but actually the central state is trying to steer what's going on and to make interventions as to the situation in the job centers. This was a figure as to the new system has been in case in work for 2 years now, in which you would see as to the red ones, this is only they can give advices from the side the local or the regional labor market boards, but they are not part of public policy any longer. But again, now a new system is going to operate from the 1st of 8 this year. This is the municipalities taking over responsibilities and also economic responsibility. What will happen here, we don't know yet. There have been no change as to the benefit level so far, whether the municipality still will help the people in the future, we don't know. But we know there will be a strong monitoring and steering system from the side of state operating. This is a clear example of policy change. And I would say we have a system transformation because both the content and the processes has been changed. You can see, as in many other systems, contractualization introduced, performance management, here from the United States, some transfer. Yeah, a new measurement system is in work from 2007, and I would say a little bit more about this. It's actually a U.S. import, but there's some really big problems in having this evidence-based system operating. It's partial because it only looks at the change in benefit situation of people. It's one-sided because it's only measuring the supply side, and it's also about last year's performance, and it doesn't help you reorient yourself now when we have this change as to the labor market situation. And finally, and most important, the role of dialogues has been watered down again. That means we will have an administrative system operating. You can also see inside the job centers, the frontline people, they are now agents for a behavioral policy. They need to give some massage to the attitudes and consciousness of the unemployed persons. They will have no further education. They will be deprofessionalized in some way. And we can see a traditional bureaucracy being developed instead of a learning organization or a professional organization. This also gives problems to the Danish activation system because suddenly you say this is tame problems instead of those wicked problems we know unemployment actually consists of. And that means you also stop giving people further education and training. They just need to follow the manuals issued at the central state. You can see Denmark is becoming more European as to institutional reform, policy science separated from policy implementation, management by objectives, substituting lawmaking. You can see all these crazy markets and standardization coming in. But in Denmark, this is a kind of re-centralization of steering instead of what's happening in other countries. In Denmark, we have a deprofessionalization. I think that Rick will tell you something about the professionalization efforts in the Netherlands or has been taking place in Finland for some years. Definitely, there are some changes there. To my opinion, we are going into bad governance. Instead for the good governance, the cooperative adaptation previously employed, in which we had some institutionalization of social dialogues at all levels, we could develop common norms and have some coupling mechanism and trust put into the system. And I can show that this is a small theory of mine. We need more common understanding, more cognition, in order also to have more cooperation. But that's not enough. We also need to have coupling mechanisms and norms developed from the side of the political system and trust and learning from the side of the actors. And if you place social partners outside this system, and if you only operate this in a standardized and bureaucratic way, then you will simply water down trust inside the system, and the results will be bad. Denmark is going from being a beautiful swan to an ugly duckling. As to labor market policy, that's my prediction. I think it's not the result yet, because we still have both rights and duties for people. We still have a universal welfare state frame. We still have some backing up from the side of the social partners. But changes are there, and those changes won't be easy to change again, I think. This could be the end to Danish flexicurity. I hope not, but there's a threat. Thank you very much.